I can't imagine that in 2018 we're going to have insurance throughout the state if we don't do something.
The state's insurance director looks for a solution to the crisis in the individual health insurance market. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, May 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, changing conditions in the Arctic Ocean has a curious name.
For it to get spicier means it's going to get warmer, and changes in temperature will affect density.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Alaska's individual health insurance market could collapse as soon as next year unless the legislature acts. That was the message delivered to lawmakers today as they consider a bill to use the state's high-risk insurance pool to help stabilize the market. Alaska is now down to a single health insurer on the individual market, that's Primera Alaska, after Moda Health gave notice this spring that it would stop offering individual plans in the state by the end of the year. Moda is the third insurer to pull out since 2013. State Insurance Division Director Lori Wing Heyer told the House Finance Committee that companies are bleeding money.
I can't imagine that in 2018 we're going to have insurance throughout the state if we don't do something.
Wing Heyer says that's because the pool of policyholders is so small and costs in Alaska are so high. The losses at insurance companies have hit Alaskans hard. Policyholders have faced back-to-back rate hikes of more than 35%. Wing Heyer says the state can expect an increase in the same range next year, and it still likely wouldn't cover all of Primera's losses. The bill before lawmakers would tax health insurance plans across the market and use that to cover some of the costs of insuring the most expensive patients. That might allow Primera to raise rates by a smaller amount, say 25% instead of 40%. But in the long term, the state needs to find other solutions, Wing Heyer says, so the legislation also asks for permission to apply for a waiver from the federal government to design an alternative health insurance system.
The Affordable Care Act was written as a one-size-fits-all, and it doesn't necessarily work for Alaska. We're much more rural than we are urban. We're further away from a lot of the more metropolitan areas. So we think that there may be some things that we can do that would bring the cost of health insurance down for Alaskans.
Governor Bill Walker added the insurance bill to the agenda for the current special session. It's one of a handful of issues on the agenda that are not related to the state's budget crisis, including proposals to reform the state's foster care system and offer insurance to the dependents of firefighters and state troopers killed in the line of duty. One of the first bills to come out of the legislative special session may be one that streamlines handling of children in state custody. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
All the testimony Wednesday before the Senate Judiciary Committee supported passage of House Bill 200. The bill springs from a lawsuit involving a grandmother in the southwest Alaska village of Tununuk. She testified in court that she wanted to adopt her granddaughter with the understanding her testimony would give her standing under the Indian Child Welfare Act. ICWA gives preference to the relatives, family, or tribe of Native children in custody and adoption cases. However, after a 2013 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Alaska Supreme Court ruled a petition to adopt filed by a non-Native family outweighed the grandmother's verbal statement. Office of Children's Services Director Christy Lawton said House Bill 200 would provide an easier first step.
So this bill really provided that consideration that we have something less formal than a written petition for adoption. That really is not necessary at the beginning of the case, but that all people would eventually have to file if they became the adoptive identified parent.
Tribes say filing a petition to adopt in state court is hard to accomplish in remote villages and requires the services of an attorney. Lawton says filing a proxy would be easier.
All they have to do is let us know. They can do that via email, via fax. They can stand up in court at a meeting. And that will then begin a process by which we will formally notify the parties, we'll assess them, and the court will recognize them as relatives, and that will be preserved on the record.
In their testimony, people described delays as children's cases move from one court to another, requiring subsequent judges to become educated about a child's situation. Carla Erickson is the Child Protection Services Supervisor in the Alaska Department of Law. She says House Bill 200 would have one judge handle several legal procedures for a family.
We've been calling this the kind of the one judge, one family notion, and that we're rolling in the adoption and guardianship proceedings and the civil custody proceedings as well.
Tribal Administrator Lawrence Armour of Klawak was one of several people who said it's important to keep Native children close to their roots.
By making it easier for a family member to let the court know that they are willing to raise their relative and by leaving it with one judge that has been following the case, I think that'll help people save money and, most importantly, keep our children close to family, their community, and culture. It is just really difficult to see people in our small communities, you know, people that we love, struggling to keep their families whole.
Senator Peter McChicky of Kenai said it took his family a year and a half to adopt a child abandoned at birth, so he doesn't want to be overly lenient to absent or deadbeat parents, but he asked OCS Director Lawton if a streamlined process would still protect the rights of parents. She replied House Bill 200 would have no effect on parental rights.
Us discussing, you know, potentially this relative coming forward and saying, I'm interested, I would be willing to be the temporary and permanent placement, doesn't change anything for the parent because we're still required by law to give them every opportunity to work their case plan to be successfully reunited. So this doesn't expedite us moving towards a goal other than reunification any differently than we are now.
House Bill 200 puts emergency regulations issued last year by Governor Bill Walker into law and clarifies that proxies can be used in cases of adoptions by non-natives as well as natives. Judiciary Committee Chair Liesl McGuire says she expects House Bill 200 to quickly move to the Senate floor for consideration. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The Arctic is one step closer to having a new U.S. icebreaker. The full Senate Appropriations Committee this morning passed a bill that includes $1 billion for a heavy-duty polar ship. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the money would fully fund a goal she's worked toward for years.
We've made little bits and pieces and, you know, $8 million here and $3 million there, and that doesn't buy you a porthole.
The Homeland Security and Defense spending bills now go to the Senate floor. Murkowski issued a list of Alaska items in them. They include an extra $100 million to speed acquisition of F-35As, the aircraft that will be based at Eielson Air Force Base near Fairbanks. The senator says the bills also have $22 million for upgrades at the Kodiak Coast Guard Base, plus $10 million for state-run missile launch facilities like the one on Kodiak Island and another in Maryland. Murkowski says she added language directing the Coast Guard to consider homeporting more ships in Alaska. She told her colleagues that national security cutters in particular need to be closer to the Arctic.
We have NSCs that are sitting in Alameda, California, the closest home port that we have right now. That is 2,200 miles away.
That's just the distance to Kodiak, Murkowski said, and only halfway to Point Barrow. The Arctic Ocean is getting spicier. A new study published in the Journal of Physical Oceanography suggests that rising temperatures in the far north could result in warmer, saltier water, or what's known as spicier water. As KNOM's Emily Russell reports, this could make marine mammal hunting off Alaska's coast more dangerous.
Yep, you heard that right. The Arctic Ocean is about to get spicier. Mary Louise Timmermans is a professor and oceanographer at Yale University. She studies how ocean circulation affects sea ice in the Arctic.
For it to get spicier means it's going to get warmer, and changes in temperature will affect density to the same measure that changes in salinity affect density.
Everyone knows the deeper you go in the ocean, the colder it gets, right? That's because cold water is more dense than warm water, so naturally it sinks to the ocean floor. But Timmerman says the dynamics are different in the Arctic.
At low temperatures, the water doesn't really care whether it's warm or cold.
Seawater in the Arctic Ocean is so cold, the temperature isn't the deciding factor in its density. Instead, Timmerman says salinity, or how salty the water is, makes more of a difference. But that's about to change as the climate changes.
As you warm up the ocean, it turns out that then temperature changes can have a bigger impact on density than in a cooler ocean.
Timmerman's teamed up with Stephen Jane of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. The two found that a spicier Arctic will likely be able to store more heat.
This means that the way the Arctic Ocean works will be somewhat different.
It's tough to predict just how different the Arctic will be, but Timmerman says warmer seawater may speed up sea ice melt. That's bad news for marine mammal hunters like Brandon Amasek.
The sea ice, it offers a protective barrier. It keeps the ripples, waves down, keeps them from forming.
Amasek is Coeric's subsistence director based in Nome. He grew up out on the water hunting with his dad. He now takes his own kids with him to hunt for bearded seal, or ugruk, and walrus.
When you have that large open water, it's more susceptible to large waves, bad weather.
He says if warmer, saltier seawater makes for thinner, sparser sea ice, most hunters won't fare too well in their standard 18-foot lun boats.
Your side height on a lun boat is only about 28 inches, but if you got 4 or 6 foot rollers coming at you, you're probably not going to want to be out there.
But some villages, especially the ones without grocery stores to rely on, might not have any other choice. Despite the potentially more dangerous conditions, to hunters like Amasek, a spicier ocean is still the best grocery store around. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, state game managers ask the subsistence board to reverse a caribou closure.
For now, we're advising hunters to prepare for a federal land closure in the fall.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is trying to repeal a controversial decision on caribou hunting in the West Arctic. Last month, the Federal Subsistence Board voted to close thousands of acres of public lands to all but local hunters, citing the caribou herd's declining population and the need to protect subsistence. But in a letter sent yesterday, Fish and Game asked the board to reconsider the year-long closure, arguing it would actually hurt subsistence hunters without helping the herd. Lem Butler is the Assistant Director for Fish and Game's Division of Wildlife Conservation. He says state officials were surprised at the closure because the Northwest Arctic caribou herd is showing signs of improvement.
It's been declining, but recent evidence indicates that it's beginning to stabilize. We've seen better adult survival rates, better calf recruitment. Our models are predicting that the population, again, is doing well.
On top of that, Butler says outside hunters account for just 5% of the total harvest, which means kicking them off federal lands wouldn't do much to conserve the herd. Instead, he says the closure would drive more hunters onto state lands and cause overcrowding.
We also think that it's going to increase the user conflicts for locals, particularly along the Noatak and Kobuk rivers. You know, a lot of the non-locals now be forced to hunt in those areas as well, so people will be competing for caribou and interacting on the river in a way that probably isn't going to really help the situation.
Butler says the state wants to work with local communities and the federal board to cut down on existing conflict between local and outside hunters while ensuring the herd can provide for subsistence users in the long term. That's why managers have introduced new bag limits and restrictions on the length of the caribou season, measures that Butler calls less extreme than a closure. But Carl Johnson with the Office of Subsistence Management says the closure is not eligible for reconsideration because it was made by a temporary special action outside of the typical regulation cycle. He says Fish and Game would have to propose a new special action and get the board to approve it in order to reverse the decision. Butler says the state is willing to propose a special action, but he's not sure it would reopen federal lands in time for caribou season.
For now, we're advising hunters to prepare for a federal land closure in the fall. I think the process may be slow, and it's difficult to say whether or not we'll have any satisfaction in our request before the hunting season begins.
If the decision isn't overturned, the year-long closure will go into effect on July 1st. Hundreds of people have traveled to the Alaska Peninsula this month for a chance to bag a brown bear. Most hunters are non-residents who hire guides and charter flights, driving an estimated $10 million of economic activity. KDLG's Hannah Colton went to the hub of the bear hunt action in King Salmon and has the story.
On the bank of the Naknek River in King Salmon is Float Plane Row, where a hunter just flew in from the field. He's got a hide laid out on the gravel alongside a bloody bear skull. He's waiting for Dave Crowley and Chris Peterson. They're wildlife biologists from the local Fish and Game office, and they set up shop on the tailgate of their pickup truck.
This is a caliper and a ruler. I am measuring the length and the width of the skull. You add that together and you get skull size.
When hunters, like this guy from Anchorage, get back with their trophies, this is one of the first boxes they have to check. They have to get Fish and Game to seal the skull and the hide. It's a quick inspection to take some samples.
I'm just taking a hair sample for DNA.
And to make sure the hunter has crossed his T's yep. and dotted his I's.
Okay. All right, thank you. Congratulations. Great job. Yep.
Back in town, I stop in at the King Salmon Airport. Penn Air agent Lisa Davis tells me she's been checking bear hides for successful hunters all week. She had six yesterday, packed up in plastic bags or totes.
We have a lot of hunters that come in with bears, and you generally know because they do stink. Even if they're carefully prepared, when they come in, they smell very bad.
By now, she's used to the smell, but she says getting these on the plane doesn't always go smoothly.
Oh, yeah, we had a passenger come in last night whose baggage was overweight for his bear hide, and he had to lose 20 pounds, so he suggested that he take it outside, cut off the feet so that it would be underweight so that he could get it on the plane last night. We went ahead and let him ship it as cargo so that he did not have to do that.
The noon flight to Anchorage just got canceled. It's left one hunter sitting in the lobby waiting for the next flight out.
My name's Wayne Hott. I'm a retired Air Force dentist. I live in Wichita, Kansas.
Wayne is a trim 68-year-old. He wears a crisp wool button-up and clean matching camos, and he's fiddling with his smartphone.
I think one of my family just replied back to the text with the picture of the bear. Let me see what they said.
Wayne Hott has been waiting years for this moment. He says he's hunted lots of big game all over the world, but brown bears have been a sore spot since he had three unsuccessful attempts in Southeast Alaska over a decade ago.
And I did other things to try and forget about the brown bear. But obviously, I couldn't forget about it completely.
According to rates listed on the AAA Alaskan Outfitters website, Wayne shelled out more than $24,000 for a 15-day guided hunt on the Alaska Peninsula. His first week in the field, the weather was iffy. A few good hunting days and a couple rainy ones spent in the tent. Then his luck turned.
Must have been Monday. Yeah, Monday was day 8 of my hunt.
Wayne and his guide were in a pop-up blind when they spotted a sow with two cubs on the side of the mountain.
And all of a sudden, there was this lot bigger bear above them and came down toward them. And the two bears were just nose-to-nose like a couple of dogs posturing at each other. And this was like a mile off, but we could see them.
Finally, the bigger bear left the others. It started moving down the mountain toward a grassy spot in the valley that looked promising.
We grabbed our packs and took off at 4 o'clock and shot the bear at 4:45. And we were back in camp, I think, either 7:30 or 8 o'clock with the bear skinned.
They left the rest of the carcass in the field for scavengers to find. Wayne decided he'd had enough rain and cramped tents, so he headed back to King Salmon. Now his 9-foot bear hide continues its journey. It'll be cleaned, salted, and then FedExed back to Kansas, where Wayne has a favorite taxidermist on call.
The thing that's so remarkable about the bear, though, is that I like the most in my wife, and it's important because she's always asking me where we're going to put the next one. She'll love this because it's beautiful. If you took a color scale that started at dark brown and went to a light tan and did a continuum of color variations through that spectrum, this bear's got all of them. It's a beautiful, beautiful specimen.
Besides looks, what Wayne loves about this bear is the fact that he shot it with ammunition he made himself. He says this is the fourth time he's taken dangerous game with his own hand-loaded ammunition.
It's the satisfaction of taking the components that go together to make a rifle cartridge and making it work, having it shoot accurately, and then having it perform well when it better perform well. You know, if you're trying to take a Cape Buffalo or a leopard or a brown bear, ammunition better work. Better work.
Eventually, the bear will be mounted with the rest of the Hott family collection. Wayne wants his bear on a grassy base in a natural position, so not fierce or growling. But he does want the teeth clearly visible. He is a retired dentist, after all. Reporting in King Salmon, I'm Hannah Colton.
A man was charged with DUI, theft, and criminal mischief after he ran a front-end loader into an Anchorage Brown Jug liquor store in order to rob it at around 3 a.m. this morning. The driver, identified by police as 38-year-old Joseph Martin, allegedly stole the loader from a nearby construction site. He then proceeded to ram the brown jug, the forklift attachment demolishing the front entrance. No citizens were harmed. However, there is extensive property damage to the liquor store. After a brief, slow pursuit, police apprehended Martin and he was charged with trespassing, theft, criminal mischief, and a felony DUI.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Snow in the northernmost town in the nation is melting earlier than ever before on record. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's observatory in Barrow reported a snow melt starting on May 13th. That's 10 days earlier than the previous record set in 2002. NOAA has been recording snow melt from its Barrow Observatory for more than 70 years. The record melt follows a winter of record-setting temperatures. Alaska was more than 11 degrees warmer than normal this winter, and the winter didn't just see an early melt on land. According to the National Snow and Ice Data Center, 2016 also saw the lowest winter sea ice extent in satellite history. State parks officials have closed a section of trail in Big Delta State Historical Park near Delta Junction because the Tanana River has been cutting sharply into its southern bank where the trail is located. The extreme erosion now threatens a couple of historic cabins within the park. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, state and local officials are working on a plan to shore up the bank and to come up with a way to pay for it.
State Park Superintendent Brooks Ludwig says the agency closed part of the trail earlier this month due to safety concerns.
The erosion has gotten within right almost up to the trail, and we had to close a section of the trail off to protect the people there at the facility.
We are very concerned.
Delta Historical Society Board Vice President Susie Sandy says the erosion also threatens important attractions in Big Delta State Historical Park.
That's a big part of our community, that site down there, and a big part of the history of Alaska.
The park includes Rika's Roadhouse, where travelers along the old Fairbanks to Valdez Trail could rest and, before a bridge was built, catch a ferry to get to the other side. The park also includes a couple of fully restored cabins used more than a century ago by signal soldiers with the Washington-Alaska Military Cable and Telegraph System, or WOMCATS. and one of the cabins sits maybe 20 feet from a drop-off formed by the Tanana chewing into the southern bank.
It would be just a travesty if those cabins go into the river.
Ludwig says after he learned about the problem a few weeks ago during breakup, he brought in engineers to evaluate the situation. He says they're working on a plan to shore up the bank, employing the same technique used about 10 years ago on a stretch of the bank near Rika's Roadhouse that the Tanana was also eroding away.
To really tie the whole bank along there and protect the entire park, we need to do another about 450 feet of bank stabilization.
Ludwig says the engineers estimated the project would cost about $700,000, which he acknowledged, considering the state's fiscal crisis, might require requesting help from the federal government or other source.
The state's broke, so it's hard to come up with capital money at this time.
Sandy says the Historical Society also doesn't have money like that, but would be willing to spearhead an effort to fundraise it.
The Historical Society is willing to step up and do whatever's necessary in terms of writing letters and contacting people.
Sandy says her other and perhaps bigger concern is time. She says the work should be done soon, not 5 years from now, which is how long Ludwig says it took to get funding for the first bank stabilization project 10 years ago. Sandy says if the river gets too close to the cabins, she'd support jacking them up and moving them away from the river. Ludwig says he'd go along with that, but would prefer to keep them in their present location to protect their historical authenticity. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A public radio station based in Seattle and serving the Puget Sound region announced today it has raised enough money to stay on air. In November, Pacific Lutheran University announced it would sell the license for KPLU 88.5 FM to another public radio station in the area owned by the University of Washington. But as the station's general manager, Joey Cohn, told listeners today, 17,000 individuals and businesses donated enough money to buy the license instead.
I am very excited to announce today that we reached our goal of $7 million.
Supporters formed the Friends of 88.5 FM Group, which is negotiating the terms of the sale. A final purchase still has to be worked out and receive FCC approval. Cohn estimates it'll be September or October before KPLU becomes its own independent community-licensed radio station. Some of the KPLU staff are former members of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Reporters Gabriel Spitzer, Ashley Gross, Ariel Van Cleve, and afternoon host Ed Ronco. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Laura Craigle and Emily Russell in Nome, Rachel Waldholtz in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jacqueline Estes, Wesley Early, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. Mount Edgecombe High School provides a curriculum rich in culture and diversity, offering over 80 courses, from art to advanced engineering and with activities from native dance to kayaking. Class sizes are no larger than 30. Explore your talents and develop your dreams. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.